is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
Council is being used as an instrument of political pressure. It is a counterproductive effort to embolden the terrorist rebels and exacerbate the situation on the ground.
That's Ethiopia's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Zanabe Kabeda Koricho, on a draft resolution under consideration by the UN Human Rights Council that calls for an independent investigation into alleged abuses by all parties in Ethiopia. Details coming up also. In Nigeria, rapes are still on the rise. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The UN Human Rights Council is considering a draft resolution that calls for an independent international investigation into violations and abuses being committed by all parties to the conflict in Ethiopia. The council is holding an urgent session to address the grave human rights situation in Ethiopia. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
A joint investigation of the situation in Tigray, issued last month by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, found a breathtaking litany of crimes against civilians and civilian infrastructure. These include torture, extrajudicial executions, and sexual and gender-based violence, including gang rapes. It also describes violations against tens of thousands of Eritrean refugees and the forced displacement of more than 2.5 million civilians. The report found members of the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, Tigrayan Rebel Forces, and Eritrean Defense Forces committed acts that could amount to international crimes, including war crimes and crimes against humanity. In her presentation to the Council on Friday, UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashif, said the scope and breadth of crimes being committed by the warring parties had increased alarmingly. She noted the Ethiopian government said it would undertake impartial investigations into alleged serious violations and would implement some of the report's recommendations. She said this has not yet been done.
Recent actions by the authorities in the context of the state of emergency appear inconsistent with the government's expressed commitment to implement the recommendations of the Joint Investigation Report. The onus is on the state to discharge its primary responsibility to deliver fair and independent proceedings that address the full range of violations identified.
In the absence of significant accountability efforts on the part of the government, Al-Nashif said it would be important to create an international investigative mechanism. The resolution under consideration calls for the appointment of a 3-member commission of human rights experts to conduct thorough investigations into rights abuses in Ethiopia. The team would report back on its findings to the Human Rights Council within a year. Ethiopia's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Zanebi Kabede Kocho, denounced the resolution, calling it politically motivated.
Underhand manner this special session was initiated shows the ulterior political objective. Council is being used as an instrument of political pressure. It is a counterproductive effort to embolden the terrorist rebels and exacerbate the situation on the ground.
Corcho said his government will not cooperate with any mechanism that may be imposed upon it. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Children's Fund has launched $9.4 billion emergency funding appeal to reach more than 327 million people, including 177 million children affected by humanitarian crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic worldwide. Much of that appeal will go to help communities in southern and eastern Africa. Mavis Ochera in Juwaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more.
The humanitarian appeal is at $1.1 billion for the 21 countries in the southern and eastern Africa region, with 95 million children targeted. Petit Manfield is UNICEF's regional advisor for emergencies for eastern and southern Africa. He says the appeal is a 17% increase compared with last year. He says the main drivers for the humanitarian crisis in the region are conflict, climate shocks, and public health emergencies like the COVID-19 pandemic.
We're looking at a dramatically increased impact on children in northern Ethiopia, in fact spreading right across Ethiopia due to the ongoing conflict, which started just over a year ago. Mozambique and the north of Mozambique in Cabo Delgado still seeing just shy of 1 million people displaced, slightly over half of which are women and children, a significant level of humanitarian response. And we're seeing rising drought risks in both southern Africa and the Horn of Africa, particularly now in Somalia.
Manfield says food insecurity in Somalia was projected to rise to 4.6 million people from the current level of 3.8 million, in large part because of water scarcity. He says the COVID-19 pandemic continues to impact countries. There was still the need to protect frontline workers and institute measures to keep the spread of the virus, especially with the new Omicron variant. Manfield says in sub-Saharan Africa, the cost to deliver COVID-19 vaccines is high in isolated communities in countries like Somalia, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Mozambique, and Madagascar.
It's also the case that COVID continues to restrict regular access to a range of essential services, particularly education, health, and social welfare systems, and is competing for funds with regular or underlying drivers of humanitarian need in all countries in the region. This is impacting children primarily through a lack of access to essential services as a consequence of the constraints and the lockdowns and the reappropriation of government resources towards COVID to protect older vulnerable groups.
He says it was essential for humanitarian services to remain accessible to children, that children under 5 are especially vulnerable to other communicable diseases such as measles. Manfield says school closures during the pandemic mean millions of children still need to catch up with classes. He says his organization continued to monitor to ensure children's rights were not violated in countries experiencing conflict, including Ethiopia and Mozambique. He says UNICEF will continue to partner with governments in the region to ensure COVID-19 transmission was arrested and that government had helped to roll out vaccination campaigns. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
In Nigeria, rapes are still on the rise 1 year after the government declared a state of emergency on gender and sexual violence. From Abuja, Munachi Chuks sought the views of some activists on the failure of the government to tackle the crisis.
An update on the situation was included in a recent report entitled Nigeria, a Harrowing Journey: Access to Justice for Women and Girls Survivors of Rape. The global human rights advocacy group Amnesty International says that the failure of the Nigerian government to tackle rape and other cases of gender-based violence emboldens its perpetrators. In June 2020, the Nigerian government declared a nationwide state of emergency on rape after a series of harrowing crimes. Activists described the state of emergency as an empty declaration. Lemi Uhebe is an activist and convener of the group Men Against Rape. He says nothing has been done by the government to protect women and girls.
Government has not backed the declaration with any action. If anything, the conspiracy of silence and inaction of government is the reason sexual and gender-based violence is not just persisting, it is at a critical level. It is not abating at all.
Wanda Ebe is a survivor and founder of Wanda Aldu Foundation, an NGO that seeks to defend marginalized women in society. She blames corruption in the justice system for hindering victims and survivors from getting justice.
if, first of all, we admit that rape is a criminal offense and a human rights violation, then we will treat rape cases differently. But we take a lot of things for granted. We have this entitlement mentality in Africa, in Nigeria specifically. And that is why, you know, men believe that a woman should be violated.
Gender-based violence has long been a major problem in Nigeria. Many survivors and family members of victims do not trust the police because they have witnessed the culture of victim blaming and seen allegations that are improperly investigated. A mother of a victim, Vivian Akbaha, tearfully narrated how her late daughter, Karen Hapuk, who was in junior secondary class, was molested at her school.
Early hours of Tuesday, 22nd June, my daughter gave up the ghost from infections caused by the condom left in her, which led to sepsis, which triggered hyperglycemia. She died. She just left.
Wow. She deplored how difficult seeking justice for her daughter has been.
There have been a lot of challenges. Where I reported the case to, that's the police command, refused to release the medical or autopsy reports they gave them. Rather, they gave the school. The school have a lot of money, so they have been doing a lot to keep this undercover.
In Nigeria, women are increasingly turning to protests and social media to call out perpetrators and hold them accountable. Activist and survivor Dorothy Njemanze is calling on law enforcement agencies and government to take further steps to bring the accusers to book.
We're tired of people talking and talking. We want people to walk the talk. We want whatever is being said to translate into the lived realities of people.
Despite the declaration of a state of emergency, a culture of rape and impunity persists, making it difficult for victims to get justice. But activists say they'll continue their fight until society and government take sexual violence against women seriously. For VOA News, Munachi.
The Confederation of African Football has dismissed speculation that the Africa Football Cup of Nations, scheduled for January in Cameroon, could be postponed again because of the pandemic. Secretary General of the Confederation of African Football, Veron Musengo Omba, during a visit to Cameroon on Wednesday, said the spread of the Omicron variant could affect the number of fans allowed in stadiums. Nonetheless, he said, Cameroon was prepared to host Africa's top soccer tournament, as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
The Confederation of African Football's Veron Musengo Omba says the Africa Football Cup of Nations AFCON tournament will begin in January as planned in Cameroon, despite the COVID pandemic. Britain's Daily Mail and Mirror newspapers this week speculated that the AFCON tournament, Africa's top soccer contest, might be cancelled amid a fresh wave of global infections fueled by the Omicron variant. Cameroon is expected to welcome thousands of international football fans for the games, which begin January 9 and go through February 6. Speaking Wednesday during a visit to Cameroon's coastal city Douala, the CAF's Omba said he was convinced that the host nation was ready to take appropriate measures.
C'est les autorités du pays qui vont nous dire la situation sanitaire c'est X.
He says Cameroonian authorities have assured the CAF that the spread of COVID-19 will be reduced to a minimum during the football tournament. Omba says the CAF will decide how many spectators will be allowed to attend football matches based on daily COVID-19 reports from Cameroon and the CAF's own health teams. The AFCON tournament, Africa's most prominent championship, was twice postponed due to construction delays and the pandemic. Omba said construction had advanced since initial worries that Yaounde's Olembe Stadium would not be ready, but it was now on schedule to host the opening and closing matches. Despite health campaigns, Cameroonian authorities say vaccine hesitancy in the country is still quite high. Cameroon's Ministry of Public Health says less than 4% of its targeted 16 million people have been vaccinated. Cameroon has about 26 million people. Director of Cameroon's AFCON tournament, Michelle Disakembarga, says fans will have to present a negative COVID test not older than 24 hours to enter the stadiums, regardless of vaccination status.
When you are vaccinated, at least you have some sort of advantage. But each time this match, only those who are tested negative will have access to the stadium. The Secretary General of CAF assured us that they were going to have a particular laboratory from Europe which will help the players to access the stadium.
The Omicron variant, first reported in South Africa in November, has since been confirmed in scores of countries around the world. Experts say it appears to spread more easily than other COVID variants to evade some vaccines, but also to have milder symptoms. The thousands of fans expected to gather in Cameroon's stadiums for the AFCON tournament has also raised safety concerns. Anglophone separatists in Western Cameroon have threatened attacks on two towns with stadiums that will host some of the matches. Cameroonian authorities, however, have assured football fans and players that AFCON will be safe despite the threats. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
South Africa once had one of the best rail networks on the continent, transporting millions of people and all manners of goods across the country. Today, however, most railways are silent while roads crumble under the weight of taxis, buses and overloaded trucks. Darren Taylor reports that many in the transport field want the government to scrap the entire rail system.
Business journalist David Williams has been researching the erosion of rail infrastructure in South Africa. He says the African National Congress government gets too much of the blame for mismanaging the rail network since it came to power in 1994.
People say, oh, the ANC government has wrecked the railways. It's not the case. This started back in the 1970s when the road transport sector was deregulated, without thought of how do we keep the right traffic on the rails.
This deregulation, says Williams, sparked the rise of the minibus taxi industry. It's now the biggest form of transport in South Africa, used by tens of millions of people every day. Today, the government has little control over the taxi sector, which Williams describes as a law unto itself. Slowly but surely, he adds, freight that used to be shipped by rail across the country was shifted to the highways. Williams says further neglect of railways resulted when the National Party government dissolved the railway police in the 1980s.
And the result was that the railways were no longer policed. And it didn't take long for the criminal syndicates to realize that there was all this juicy infrastructure just waiting to be stolen or vandalized or wrecked, which is what's happened particularly in the last 20 years.
Documents from the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa, or PRASA, show there's almost 500 kilometers of tracks that are supposed to be used for passenger trains in the province of Gauteng, which includes the cities of Johannesburg and Tshwane. But it's mostly useless, says Williams.
Almost all of that, the overhead equipment, the electrical wires that feed the current to the locomotives, is gone. Most of the suburban stations look like bomb sites, except the rubble has been removed. In Cape Town, there are 2,000 people approximately living on the tracks, and PRASA can't get them off the tracks despite court orders so that they can start running trains again.
Williams says it'll cost billions of rands to restore the country's rail infrastructure.
At the moment, there are no suburban trains running, and that's down from millions of passenger journeys 10, 15 years ago. It is a complete disaster. It's the equivalent.
The government acknowledges the poor state of the rail sector and says it's committed to restoring it within a year. That's impossible, says Williams.
All the carriages have been sitting in the yards, rusting, not looked after, not maintained. The tracks, track needs to be maintained. They're like roads. If the ballast gets silted up, washaways will wash the track away. We are one of the very few countries in the world where the gangs actually steal railway lines. So there's an enormous, very expensive job here.
He isn't convinced that the Department of Transport, together with PRASA, are capable of that job.
There's a governance problem. There's corruption issues. There's policy issues. The lack of security, the lawlessness, the loss of market share. Now, everyone says, oh, well, they'll fix the trains and the passengers will come back. Well, not so easy, because the taxis and the buses and whatever else...
Transport analysts say the state would be far wiser to invest in regulation of the minibus taxi industry rather than trying to bring the rail sector back from the dead. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Claude Muhaimana, a 60-year-old French Rwandan, has been sentenced to 14 years by a French court over complicity in Rwanda's 1994 genocide. According to the French news agency AFP, the verdict came after 4 weeks of proceedings involving around 50 witnesses, some of whom came all the way from Rwanda. The French prosecutor described Muhaimana as an opportunist and accused him of contributing to the genocide by driving and transporting Hutu killers over a three-month period as they massacred hundreds of Tutsis. Muhaimana denied the charges. Some 800,000 people died between April and July 1994 as the extremist Hutu regime tried to wipe out Rwanda's Tutsi minority, resulting in one of the 20th century's biggest massacres. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Sumuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.